Welcome to Between the Lines, an Oaks Church Brooklyn podcast where we go behind the scenes of our current series, The Story of God, alongside our pastors and a few friends. We hope you enjoy.
We are back.
Back like we never left.
Look at us. Actually, should we tell the people the truth?
What's the truth?
You know the truth, that this is... this is the second time that we're back.
Yeah, you know, there's something embarrassing about this truth.
Well, first we should say who we are.
True.
For those not listening, this is Patrick Boatwright.
I'm Ryan Pastor. Diaz.
This is Between the Lines, the Good Way edition.
Yeah.
And yes, okay, so we're inside baseball.
We're back in the sense that we recorded a podcast.
Oh man, it was so good.
It was so good.
I'll tell you. Here's the thing. Here's another. I've never listened to one of our podcasts or any podcast that I've ever teached. I refuse to listen to the sound of my own voice. I understand all the benefits that could happen if I did.
Yeah.
But that's just the cross I will bear. And this, what we recorded.
Yeah. What we were attempting to record, you would have listened to.
I legitimately was like, I'm going to go back and listen to this because this is really good stuff.
Yeah.
And I was like, man, that you made a really good point. And I was like, let me check the timestamp.
I was feeling profound.
Man, I'm so sorry. Honestly, and then there was probably like the cure for cancer. There was like world
something
peace.
In there,
we had cured 10 more minutes and we were going to solve all global conflicts. And I looked down and realized that I had not pushed record because the one person that isn't here
is Anthony,
our producer, Anthony Jaffiers. And so, it's honestly Anthony's fault.
It is.
So we'll just leave it at that.
And that whole conversation is lost to the annals of time.
Yeah. You know, but you know, here we are. So
we're back. Yeah. For real this time.
But we're not also back.
Yeah.
So meaning this is Between the Lines. This is the Story of God edition. This is the Good Way edition.
Yeah.
And we're coming in because we are doing our annual move through the Good Way.
Yeah, our 8 intentions we keep as a community.
Exactly. And so we've been doing that on Sunday mornings, and we felt like, hey, it'd be really good at the halfway point to come and kind of do a mailbag of sorts.
Yeah, just kind of, I mean, whenever you talk about spiritual practices or spiritual intentions, how we order our lives, there's just so much to cover because not only is how we understand these things, but then actually how we live into them. And that's really where the rubber meets the road.
Yeah, exactly. So we're going to spend a little bit of time kind of just talking through some of the questions that have come out of the Good Way course for those who've been attending it.
Yeah.
Just a few kind of top of the cream. I don't even know what that phrase is there, but
it's a new one.
Yeah,
Coin it. You're with me.
That's fine. Those questions that have risen to the top about the Good Way, maybe some of the particular practices or intentions that we hold.
I see what you did there. Cream of the crop. And then you went.
And I tried to take it to the top.
And now we're here.
You know, say it, but say it with a slant. all right. So we're going to get into these questions, and then we will be back at the end of the Good Way series, which will be the end of October, end of this month. And we'll come back with kind of another update of this mailbag, which we want to invite people. They can, between now and then, send in questions. We got an email.
We do have an email.
Look at us.
Yeah, we're official now.
We may be becoming podcasters.
You know, I said I'd never do it, but here I am.
Who would have thought?
Who would have thought?
So people can send questions into betweenthelines@oakschurch.bk. Between now and then, if you have any questions in our community or outside of our community and you're listening to this, about rule of life, about contemplative Christian practice and the ways we're ordering our lives and some of the intentions that we carry, happy to answer those in our next mailbag. But I think that's enough for now. Why don't we actually get into these questions?
Let's do it.
Okay. So I would say probably one of the biggest questions, and this has been asked a couple of different ways by a lot of different people.
Mm-hmm.
We're talking about rule of life. There's immediately for some of us that's like, oh no.
Yeah. Rules.
Rules. Yeah. Rules. Something I've got to get done. Something I have to abide by. And when we talk about, when we give this kind of understanding of rule of life and it leading intentions that lead us into practices, there's some version of the question of how does my rule of life, how do I carry these intentions and the practices I use to live into those intentions without it just being another like checklist, another thing we've got to get done. And obviously we live in New York City.
Yeah, a lot to get done.
There's always so much to get done. You know, there's, it's a, who has laundry in their house? Like, you often just walk into the laundromat and you want me to also like read my Bible every day?
Yeah, I think, you know, in that question is a, is one thing I think is a inherent in that question is an inherent kind of innate dualism, that there is my normal everyday secular life.
Yes.
And then there is the spiritual religious part of my life, and never the twain shall meet, right? Mm-hmm. Like, these are two things that occur. And so I live my regular everyday life, and then I go, darn it, I have a spiritual life too. And now I got to do that kind of stuff. And so I would begin to answer this question by actually investigating that kind of implicit dualism we carry as Westerners. We're all sort of children of Plato in that way. And say, like, why
do we... I don't play with Plato.
Oh, man. Wow, that was good. That's a dad joke.
Yeah, thank you.
I'm still waiting for someone to tell me I've told a dad joke now that I'm a dad. You know, so...
They're now just the jokes that you tell.
Yeah. It just fully becomes that.
Yeah, yes.
But yeah, we all kind of have inherited this sort of, there's my religious life, there's my kind of secular life. And yes, when that's the case, then yeah, there's a lot to do. Mm-hmm. Because there's a whole other life you have to live outside of your secular life.
So I'm hearing you speak to something of a sanctified life, all things being holy. I think of Tish Harrison Warren has that book, Liturgy of the Ordinary.
Yeah.
And how we consider even the way we make our coffee to be a sacrament, to be could be something
holy.
Things holy. Yeah. So is that kind of how you approach this conception of rule of life that then reorients you?
Yeah. I think I would begin there. I would begin by looking at my, where we have the rule of life gives us kind of these intentions as buckets. And I think a healthy and helpful place to begin is to look at, what do I already do where I am, could be experiencing the presence and love and intimacy of Jesus that I'm just missing because I have not have eyes to see it. And I think beginning from that place and realizing I'm already living a spiritual life in my ordinary life. I'm already in some ways pursuing justice and peace. I'm already living out the story of God and recognizing those things as actual spiritual practices, those ordinary parts of my life that are spiritual. I think for myself, you know, when I was on paternity leave and, you know, a crying baby in the middle of the night, kind of soothing him back to sleep. And I just found myself praying the part of the evening office I had memorized. And it wasn't like, I am now going to pray the evening office to pray. I just found it whispering in my son's ear and just saying, you know, guide us waking, O Lord, and guard us sleeping, that awake we may rise with Christ and asleep we may rest in peace. And that was just, that whole moment was a spiritual moment. It was my practice being lived out of rhythms of prayer without saying, now I must set aside time to pray. Even though we can get into maybe the practicalities of maybe having rhythmic times.
Yeah.
But even those rhythmic times are to get to that place where St. Paul talks about like praying without ceasing, to the lived life.
Yeah, it's an orientation. I think what comes up for me when we talk about rule of life here, and you know, again, there's some aspect. You think of like Saint Benedict and or some of the even the earliest monastery movements, Pacomius, and people that are establishing like monks who live out a certain way. But beyond that, you have, you know, these early Desert Mothers and Fathers who are essentially leaving the trappings of, you know, Rome and, and cosmopolitan Christianity and are seeking something that feels incarnate, that feels in some ways costly.
Yeah.
I think. But they're also just trying to get their sense of Jesus. To identify with him, to be intimate with Jesus. And the Jesus they knew wasn't a person of like leisure, like of, you know. And so I think that, yeah, there's a whole lot I could say about that. But I think where that takes me to is that the roots of contemplation, contemplative practice, of rule of life has always been about seeking intimacy with Jesus. And the way I hold my rule of life is that these are the avenues, these are the intentions I keep in my life, the intentionality in which I live, that I express by keeping practices, practices that shift and change according to my personality, according to my season of faith, or my stage of faith, or my season of life. And so these the practices themselves change, but the way I orient my life doesn't. And what I orient my life to is intimacy with Jesus, because Jesus says in John 15 that in doing so, my life will bear much fruit when I abide with him and he abides with me. And so the question is, how do we abide? How do we abide?
It's interesting. I think because what you're proposing there is a radical reframing of a life, which is to say, Jesus is not something I fit into my life. He is the place from which it flows and flows back to. And like, that's a radical way of living in that you now look at your entire life through that lens.
Yes. And here's another implication. I think this is kind of even speaks more to the matter. What is our relationship to our faith? Do we have a relationship with Jesus, or do we have a religion based on Jesus? Because a religion is a set of, you know, sacramental principles and beliefs and doctrines that are orients their way around. You are a Mets fan.
oh God, this is a tender place.
Yes,
to go
you know,
to
the gods we serve, but but being a Mets fan orients certain things about your life.
Yeah,
you know where. Well, I was gonna say you know where you'll be in October, but that's not really true. You know where you will be opening day.
Yeah.
You're watching the Mets
City Field. Yeah.
Yeah. You know the songs that you're going to sing at the seventh inning stretch.
Come on.
You know the chants of the Mets. That's a faith practice. We have a lot of different faiths, but to have a relationship with Jesus, that's something altogether different. Yes, you want to know the facts of being married to your wife, but that doesn't supplant going on a walk with her. And so practically, you know, I offered this to kind of wrap this question up. I kind of offered this example. Going to the gym. Going to the gym was not on my rule of life, though it was something I was doing rhythmically. And I had started, I trained as a strongman, and my trainer literally is named Hans. I think he was required by law to change it. So I trained as a strongman, and for those who don't know, it's kind of those old ESPN competitions where dudes are like
throwing refrigerators.
Yes, the first one is like Lou Ferrigno bending a crowbar.
That's crazy.
Yeah, it's so wild. So we've come a long way. But anyway, all that to say is, I started going to this gym regularly, but it was totally based out of just a real contempt for my body, a real contempt, just looking at myself and going, oh, look at you. You need to do something with yourself. We've got to get in shape, and like we've got to move our body. And so I was going to the gym regularly, twice a week. I'm training. And it's all coming from this real kind of like tense and honestly not that life-giving place. Mm-hmm. It's not on my rule of life, even though one of the intentions that we carry is a pursuit of wholeness and holiness, which includes physical maturity, mm-hmm. taking care of our bodies. Because there was no actual intimacy with Jesus. And then as I was moving into this, there was something sparking in my spirit around that. Like, I actually want intimacy with Jesus in this place that doesn't feel like life. It feels like death. And so here is how I put the gym on my rule of life. It wasn't the practice of going to the gym, but I added a practice. Before I walk into the gym, I'm going to say a simple prayer, which is, Jesus, thank you for my body, the gift you've given to me in it and through it. Help me to see something new and help me to understand how beautiful it is today. And I go into the gym. And what started to happen is now when I would do these like new PRs, I would you know, do something, try some new exercise or some new feat. There was this sense of wonder that came where literally I'd be in the session and I'd be like thinking to Jesus, like, amazing that you've made me to do this.
Yeah.
And it reoriented my whole relationship to my body and to even going to the gym. It did not make the gym necessarily always easier to do, but it did produce intimacy with Jesus because now I saw my body through his eyes, and that then bore the fruit of like self-control, the ability to go, of loving kindness towards myself, of patience with myself when I couldn't get something. So I think that's what it looks like to move from a religious checklist to a Jesus-oriented life.
That's good.
All right. Here's another question. This one's particular. It's dealing with our intention of having lives deeply rooted in the story of God.
Yeah.
And essentially the question has come up is like, okay, how do I build practices or set an intention to engage a story that I wrestle with? Wonder what you'd say to that.
Yeah, it's interesting, right? Because one of our intentions and one of actually what makes us Christians is that we believe we are living a story, and that the story is a particular story about a particular God and a particular person. And yet, the way that story is told leaves us as questions. And there's something I think innate in all of us that we want the story of God to be like a tabula rasa, like a blank slate in which we can kind of impose and write in that vision of God which makes us comfortable or feel safe. And then the great gripe we have is that we don't have a blank slate. We have a story that makes claims about God's action in history, and that story is somehow ours. And so I just want to name that's kind of the pain point there. How you begin to live that out is, I think we have to take this story and root it back in the person who's telling the story. And if our presumptions, an assessment of God, is that he's good innately. That he actually, matter of fact, St. Thomas Aquinas said he is goodness. Then I have to give myself the latitude to hold both the good God who's telling the story and the complicated world he's telling the story in. And I think that's the important piece. is that this story God is, this story this good God is telling is happening in a world in which chaos has left its boundaries. And so God's good story must happen within the borders and through the chaos of the world. And so I think what that looks like practically when it involves our practice, it's actually giving ourselves to those questions and actually living out the story of God is not necessarily answering those questions, but intending to live them out, to carry with them the rest of our lives. There's a great scene in Jaber Crow, the novel by Wendell Berry. He goes to seminary, mm-hmm. wants to become a priest, starts having all these questions. He goes to a professor that he thought was the meanest professor. He sits down, says all these questions, and the professor basically says, "Do you have answers?" "No." "Okay, you don't have answers. It sounds like you have a lot of questions." "Yeah." "Cool, go live those out." It might take your whole life. And I think that's it. That's the commitment. If we're going to hold the story and wrestle with these questions, the practice of living out the story is living through those questions.
So that's the invitation then.
Yeah.
Like that's the invitation is to, as we said, our intention, to have our lives rooted in this story.
Yeah.
Right. And recognizing that with any story, there's texture and complexities.
Yeah.
Stories aren't simple.
And they necessarily challenge us. The only stories that don't challenge us are children's stories.
Yeah.
Because those are designed to be simple, but any real story is going to have things happen that don't sit well with me. And actually then the point of that story is for me not to slam the book shut and say, "I'm done," but actually say, "Man, why didn't this sit well with me? And what does this tell me about myself? What does this tell me about the author?" And that's actually then the dance. But I think the temptation we often feel is just to close the book and say, "You know what?" And because we're really sometimes saying that moment, it's not that we're not ready to face God with those questions. We're not really, really ready to face ourselves with those questions often.
That is interesting. It makes me think, you know, someone brought this up in the Good Way course. Like, hey, how do you balance out the Jesus of John 4, who's like so patient and non-judgmental and loving towards the Samaritan woman, with the Jesus of Mark 7, who calls this Syrophoenician woman a dog, you know? It's just like, what is happening here? And, you know, and I honestly don't have a good answer, a sufficient answer, I think. It's one that I've even personally wrestled with like, Jesus, what are you doing here? And I could play Jesus PR person and put really good spin on that. But I think even when I hear you talk about this and I hear you talk about these stories and I hear you talk about rooting ourselves in it, I hear like, man, the difference again going back to relationship and religion, where if a textbook contains texture,
yeah,
if a textbook is like 2 + 2, you know, generally equals 4.
You're like, what's going on?
Yeah, what's going on here? Wait a second.
Where's the answer?
Yeah, I need the answer. I need to be able to put this in a box. You're supposed to be teaching me definitively the rules I need to live by, the way I need to go. Whereas in a story, there is, like, the characters are people, and no one is any one thing. Now, that is to say, like, what I'm not implying there is that Jesus is somehow, there's brokenness in Jesus. We know that Jesus contains a purity of humanity and divinity. And yet, we also know that Jesus had to evolve in his understanding, had to grow in his personhood, etc., or else he would not have actually been fully human.
Yeah.
Like, in the same way that his body had to literally grow from being out of a manger, I imagine his mind, emotions, his all that had to also grow without also being sinful. And so then to root myself in the story then is to not see Jesus as a human textbook. Jesus did X, so I do X. But to be rooted in a story to see how Jesus yielded in obedience to the Father in the same way that I'm invited to, which is always going to require obedience, which is always going to require faith, and not quite understanding, like, God, what are you doing?
Yeah.
You know, I, what are you doing? I trust you. I love you. And I'm also confused by you. And yet you are the story that I've rooted myself in, as opposed to the other stories of this world, of which there are a plethora.
Yeah, it's the great paradox of God revealing himself in history is that God has left himself open to interpretation.
Yes.
And that is the great mystery. That is the great. And then in his wisdom, then he says he gives us a story, but that story has its culmination in a person.
Mm-hmm.
But that is the great mystery of faith, is that God, by speaking in history, by revealing himself in history, has by necessity left himself open to interpretation.
A mystery and a gift, because imagine all the people that have walked this earth and will walk this earth, and God is supposed to be as intimate to them and as personal to them as he is to me and to you and to anyone else who's ever walked this earth. That's a tall order.
And what other vehicle can carry that but a story?
Yes. Yes. That's good. Okay. Next, we've got two more here. So the next question was really around our wholeness, which is the intention we dealt with last Sunday in our gathering.
Yeah.
But there's been a question around essentially why pursue wholeness when we also acknowledge and realize that we can't know fullness or wholeness until Jesus returns. Like, is this kind of like, is this just an exercise of futility? Is this some Sisyphean effort?
Yeah, that's a great question. I'm curious what you have to say about it, but I guess my two cents would be, I think if we wouldn't ask this question of our physical health, we would say, why? Because you could be a nihilist towards your health. You could say, well, I'm going to die anyways.
Sure.
So I could either give myself to complete licentiousness, right? I could become a utterly grotesque in how I use my body. Or I say, I'm going to die. And so I'm actually going to do everything I can to stave off death. And, you know, I'm going to not eat anything good or taste good or looks good because I want to try to survive. And
I think I've lived both of those.
Yeah, exactly. And we all have. We all tend to the extreme.
Yes.
And I think. But I think the middle ground, I think maybe the rational ground, say, yes, I'm going to die. And yet how I live this life matters. And those things aren't mutually exclusive. And so I'd give that to our wholeness. Yes, we will not see the perfection of ourselves until we see Jesus face to face. And yet how I live here matters.
It's kind of big Ecclesiastes energy.
Yeah, you know, exactly.
Just try to make a good life, you know, love the Lord.
Don't ask so many questions. Just try to be good. Easy.
Yeah, I think this is a worthwhile question. And I think even when we get into the practicalities, right? Because when we talk about our practices, sometimes our practices are in the cataphatic, like the things that we pursue to make things known. Sometimes in the apophatic, where we're abstaining from something or withdrawing from something in order to pursue intimacy with Jesus. And I think that's really stark when it comes to wholeness, particularly in some of the things that we may abstain from. Even when you think about, like, food and the example that you just used, where we introduce fasting as a practice of wholeness, right? And so, hey, I'm gonna limit myself for something in the pursuit of wholeness. I'm gonna maybe put aside. We enter into the Lenten season. I'm going to put aside this so that I can find in my death identity with a Jesus who will be resurrected, right? So for me, what this brings up is our relationship to pain.
Mm.
And here's what I mean by that. I think oftentimes when we think about wholeness, I think it's just a hop and a skip to like shalom, which is like a hop and a skip to like the garden, which is a hop and a skip. Oftentimes this kind of concept of perfection, like wholeness, meaning lacking in nothing, which is essentially kind of perfection. But I would say that's not actually when we speak about wholeness in this matter, we are actually speaking about Edenic wholeness. And when you think about the Garden of Eden, the Lord doesn't call it perfect.
He calls it good.
He calls it very good. That was the standard. And the very good was not meaning that it wouldn't need to expand and to grow. In fact, he calls it good before the animals even have names. You know?
Yeah.
He calls it good before it's filled with all sorts of people. So there is room for it to, there's an expectation for it to expand and to grow, but it's expected to do so in good relationship, in good eternal harmony with man, creation, and the God that sustains it and gives it life. And so when we think about wholeness, I think that the intention there is I want to actually live in the goodness of the garden. I share this on Sunday. My whole life I've grown up with this kind of conception of Adam and Eve as like, you know, when you say naked and unashamed, like Adam's got this like chiseled, you know, six pack and Eve is this like, you know, Holly Berry. And kind of just, you know, I would say even later in my life, kind of coming to the terms of that's not necessarily true.
Yeah.
Because in that sense, they would be naked and have no need for shame.
Yeah.
But it says they were naked and unashamed. And so Adam probably had a little pudge.
Yeah.
You know, and Eve probably had things that were hanging lower than the other. Like that's just the way it goes. But they were at a wholeness with each other.
Yeah.
And when I think about it in that way, this then leads me to practices that help me embrace actually probably particularly the places where I do hold shame and how, and that kind of takes me back to that gym example. That was a practice that was steeped in shame. And when I invited Jesus into that practice, I began to move to a place of being unashamed, and that was life and wholeness, and I'm still growing in that.
Yeah, you know, as you're speaking about that, there's a beautiful kind of corollary in the reality that in his resurrected body, Jesus retained his wounds.
Yes.
And there's something there in that, like, our vision of wholeness is what if the wholeness we are all moving towards is a wholeness in which the great shames and wounds of our lives are held differently, no longer sources of shame.
That is really good. It reminds me of Amy Kinney, My Body Is Not a Prayer Request.
Yeah.
Book about disability justice and even the way we consider for our brothers and sisters who are differently able, differently bodied, to know that wholeness exists for all of us. That's something deeper than how many toes or limbs or capabilities we possess.
Yeah.
All right. our last one before we get out of here was less of a question and more of an observation we've encountered in a lot of different ways.
Yeah.
Particularly concerning our intention to be a people, a Sabbath people. Mm. And it goes something like this. It's hard to make time for rest.
Yeah. Newsflash.
Yeah, it's hard to make time for rest. What does rest and Sabbath keeping... First, I want to hear a little bit of what it looks like in your life, especially now that it's changing. And then, you know, what conceptions guide you even as you're in the midst of a change of how you pursue rest?
Yeah. Wow. Yeah. I mean, coming off of paternity leave, my wife and I, and coming back to work with a almost 4 month old. Yeah. My conception of Sabbath rest is completely different. I will say this. I think one commitment that's keeping me through this, and then how that plays itself out. I think I often note this when people talk about Sabbath rest, just to note it for them, is that we often talk about finding time for rest, but then with our work or with other obligations or other things, we make time. And I just find that's a worthwhile thing to note, is that rest is something we feel we have to stumble upon, mm-hmm. and work is something we carve out. And so that's something I've always wanted to be aware of in my own life, is that to not treat rest like something I have to stumble upon. And often we keep that conception because we feel we're unworthy of rest, or that rest is inherently deserved or earned.
Yes.
And so, oh yeah, I found a free day. Mm-hmm. And I rested, yeah, and that assuages that kind of guilt we've inherited. That ooh, but you weren't productive today.
Yes.
Versus like, but I make time because man, the clock is demanding. And so I always want to hold that and point that out to people whenever they say it, because it is weird that we do that. So with that said, in this new season, I do not want to fall into simply finding time to rest for myself and my family.
Yeah,
I want to make time for rest, because that's what Sabbath is making time. Well, I will say what's different is that I have to change my perspective of what that rest could look like. Mm. So usually in the past, before our son Damien, like I had like a Friday personal Sabbath where I got to, you know, during the day into the evening, I got to, you know, set a time to pray and to play, as Eugene Peterson says. Now that time is spent with my son. And so now I have been actively in that Fridays. What does this new rest look like, resting with a child? And is this a necessary replacement of rest? Do I need not to replace it because it's, or do even with my child I have to say no, even I need to step back from him as well. So I have to change at least my thought process of, or my image of what that rest looks like. And so that's what I've been trying to do, is like I'm trying to make time, and I'm also at the same time trying to reimagine what that time is spent doing.
Mm. Yeah. And that's, I'm sure, you know, he's now in that little, you kind of sit him a place and he doesn't move.
Yeah.
And they sleep a lot.
Yeah.
So the concept of like resting with your child is like feasible.
Yeah. I read a book while he like played on his little mobile thing. You know,
yes.
This is great.
Sabbath. But in 10 months.
Yeah.
When he is ripping the pages out of said book.
Yeah, exactly. And then in 6 years when he's lighting it on fire.
Yes, exactly. Then resting with your child, I would honestly rather rest in prison. Like, it's just, there's no, those two things are less held together in a way.
Yeah.
Yeah, this is a kind of an interesting one, right? I like what you were saying about kind of our orientation to where we start with rest.
Yeah,
you were a former youth pastor.
Yeah,
as was I. Did you ever do the jar sermon illustration?
No, we were cool. We were in New York City.
Okay.
I love you too, though.
I see how we're doing here. Well, for the rest of the world, I think it was mandatory for every youth pastor to do the jar illustration, where you get the jar and you get the sand and you get the rock or the golf balls, and you like put it all into the jar, you know? And then the whole trick, spoiler alert, you got to put the big stuff in and then fill the put the sand in, whatever. And of course, we're just teaching people that, like, your work is sand. Mm-hmm. But yeah. It's like, but actually, my work kind of actually feels like a rock, because without it, I don't eat. So maybe where I would even take that is actually the jar itself before anything is in it. That actually, this is maybe what we have in Jesus. Is a Sabbath rest. We are a people born unto rest because we have a Father who cares for all our needs, just as he cares for the sparrow, just as he cares for the lilies. And if we have such a security, we're like the highest of like Nepo babies and trust fund babies. We have an inheritance of rest, which we start from. And then it's in that. And then if that's the situation, then I think what's on offer as I observe the Sabbath is not filling my life to the brim. Mm. Not making, as opposed to making Sabbath a rock I fit into the jar.
Yeah.
The jar, to have a jar is to have space and Sabbath. And then what I give myself to and what I consider is how much do I fill my life?
Yeah.
And so in that sense then, you know, in the same way I would imagine if I did come for money, which I don't, but if I did, I probably wouldn't have invested every last cent in the fire festival. Yeah. Because that just didn't seem like a great idea.
Yeah.
You know? And yet, I see us all as children of rest, investing all our rest we've been given into our jobs, into our productivity, and the returns just aren't hitting. Sometimes it's like a Ponzi scheme. Sometimes you get a check, but eventually you're just robbing Peter to pay Paul. So what does it look like then for Sabbath to become, and my practices of Sabbath to become, spending my rest, but observing the rest that I've been given from the Lord. And then also to that, the real impetus is that we have to, you know, I think of, for those people, you know, we have full-time jobs as pastors, even in New York City. There's a real level of privilege to the life that we live. And there are plenty of people for whom work to basically have the money to eat means I'm working, not high-paying job. And I still think that rest is an orientation that I'm speaking of is possible. But also implicates the need for community. Mm. You know, I think of, even if you talk about, you know, going to the grandparents and the grandparents, I love how you say it. We go over to the parents' house and our kid just disappears.
Like, yeah.
That's really beautiful.
Yeah.
But whether that's grandparents, whether that's a friend, whether that's our Christian community, that we would take up the cause of rest for each other. What a gift, and not just a gift, but I would say a privilege, a responsibility that we have to one another.
I'll add something real quick to that. Is that the first time we went to my in-laws' house, and you know my mother-in-law's with the baby, and like I didn't have to hold him the whole day. I remember not being able to enjoy it because I felt like I was imposing.
Yeah.
And so it took a real sense of both humility and thanksgiving, saying, no, she's gladly doing this. And so if I go off for a walk I'm not imposing. And I think for those of us who, for the people listening, like, yeah, for you to Sabbath, it will require the gift of community. There is a necessary humility and grace to actually tell yourself, I'm not imposing on my community.
Yeah, to receive the provision. Even for us that have, you know, some of us, it's like, oh, I've got the money and the time. I actually could rest because God has provided already in that way. Yeah. God's provision hasn't been in my brother or sister. It's been in this high-paying job that I have.
Yeah.
And yet I still won't receive his provision.
Yeah. There's, you know, so many people out there with all the vacation days in the world, they can never use them because of that guilt, because of that I need to keep doing.
Yeah. Hmm. Yeah. So to start from a place of rest. All right. I think that's enough. We've this is kind of a long one.
Yeah, we've rambled enough.
Yeah, that's
been
fine.
A while though.
Yeah, it's been good. It's good to be back. You know,
you press record, right?
Oh yes, I did. Woo. I would quit. That would be the end of my podcasting career. Okay, well, we will be back at the end of this series in a couple of weeks. And then Between the Lines, Story of God, its normal edition, we'll be back in November for its weekly, regularly updates.
Regularly scheduled programming.
So until then, be well.
This is Between the Lines.
It's Between the Lines. Peace. See ya.